Well, with all the preparation that tends to go into Pesach, it seems to be over quite quickly. And here we are back to Parshat Shavua, and here in Eretz Yisrael, we pulled ahead. We're a week ahead until we meet up at the pass in Parshas Behar and Bechukosai. And that brings us to consider this week the two Parshas, and they're doubling up here in the second half of Vayikra, the Parshas of Tazria and Metzora. And they deal in the main, as we know, with the condition known as Tzaras. And Parshas Metzora begins to discuss how a person recovers, how a person comes back from that condition. And if we take a look in the beginning of Parshas Metzora, Mit Hashem will have yet a recourse to Tazria. But it's a process, and it's even before we get to the korbanos of the Metzorah, which are on day 8. And on day 1, there's already a whole procedure with a very specific set of items, and they are referred to in Pasuk Dalet, Perek Yud Dalet, Pasuk Dalet. V'tziva HaKohen, the Kohen shall command, V'lakach Lamitaher, and take for the one who is becoming tohor, shtei tziporim chayos tohoros, those two birds, the eight erez, cedarwood, ushni tolas, scarlet thread, the azov, and hyssop. That's quite a specific group of items. Rashi has an interesting comment. All Rashi's comments are interesting. Rashi has a comment here on these final three items, the cedar wood and the scarlet thread and the hyssop. How are they aiding the healing or the purifying process of the Metzora? So Rashi says, on the words Ve'etz Erez, Lefisha Negoim Boim Algasus Haruach, commenting on the presence of this cedar wood, Rashi says, because the cause, and as we know, there's more than one potential cause for tzaras, but the one that is implicated here and perhaps prevalent in many of the sub-causes is that of haughtiness, gasus haruach. And that is represented by the Eitz Erez, the cedar tree, tall and proud. Perhaps this person was tall and proud, maybe a little bit too tall and proud. And that brings us to the final two items, shni tolas, the ezov, the scarlet thread, and the hyssop. How do they aid things? Says Rashi, mata konoso, what is his rectification, v'yisrapid, that he should be healed, yashpil etzbo, let him lower himself, migavoso, from his haughtiness, ketolas, uke ezov, like a worm. Shni tolas, it's thread, but it's thread that is scarlet colored, and it's colored from, it's called tolas because of the tolas, the worm that gives that red color. Ukeezov, so worm is very lowly, and so is the hyssop shrub. And that's Rashi. So this comment of Rashi, or these comments of Rashi, are very interesting because Rashi explains that all of these items ultimately relate to the condition of the Metzora, but interestingly, they don't all relate to the same aspect of his condition. Some of them reflect the problem, and others the solution. Eitz Erez, the cedarwood, doesn't help him. That's his problem. The final two items, they're the antidote, they're the antithesis of the of the cedar wood. So you have a very interesting dover bihipucho. You have these two opposites, one which is the cause of his problem, and one is it's just the way forward for solution. And these words of Rashi, which are sourced in Chazal, breed what you could call a very Jewish question. And that is, why do you need two things to represent humility? As if to say, the scarlet thread comes from a worm. A worm is a low thing. That's humility. Hyssop is a shrub. It's low. That's humility. Why does the humility need to be represented twice? An interesting shaila. I don't think these items are particularly expensive, but nonetheless, if you get the message across with one, why do you need two? There's only one representation of the haughtiness. That's the cedar. We don't take some other tall thing. So why is humility represented twice over? The Maskil LeDavid, Rabbi David Pardo, in his super commentary on Rashi, explains based on a very fascinating and well-known comment of Rambam. Rambam is famous for advocating what he calls the Shvil HaZahav, the golden mean, the middle path, whereby when it comes to almost all character traits, it's not correct for a person to go to either extreme, whether it's his disposition, whether it's his generosity, whether it's his mood, and so on and so forth. Rather, he should stay away from the extremes and stay in the middle. That's the Rambam's famous advocated approach in Hilchos Deos. But there is an exception. The exception, says Rambam, is when it comes to humility. One should not go in the middle. One shouldn't be halfway between a haughty person and a humble person. He should be all the way in the direction of humility. And indeed, a source for this position, this unusual categorization when it comes to the trait of anava, of humility, can really be found in Pirkei Avos. For we're told in Pirkei Avos, ma'od ma'od hevei shval ruach, a person should be very, very lowly of spirit. Chazal rarely use the term ma'od, and even more rarely use the term ma'od ma'od. But they do when it comes to humility. And therefore, says Maskil LeDavid, in keeping with and reflecting with the unique position with regards to the trait of humility, that's why there are two items in this healing package of the Metzora that correspond to the trait of humility. Because we've been told, ma'od, ma'od, hevei shval ruach. And that's why it has this double representation. The matter does go further, however, because, as we know, the Rambam has more than one work, and sometimes the fuller picture comes from taking into account all of the Rambam's words on a certain topic. It is true that in Hilchos Deos, that is in the Mishneh Torah, and as an aside, it's really quite fascinating that the Rambam takes matters of disposition and categorizes them as halacha. One may have thought these things are perhaps antithetical to halacha. By definition, they're not halacha. But for the Rambam, from a certain point of view, everything's halacha. And therefore, if deos are character traits, so then there's a discussion of the halachas of character traits, the correct way for these things to be. So in the Hilchos Deos, the Rambam advocates this extreme approach of ma'od, ma'od. However, elsewhere, in his Perush on the Mishnayos, the Rambam has a famous introduction to his commentary on Pirkei Avos. It's known as the Shmona Prakim. It's 8 introductory chapters, which are a body of study all unto themselves. But there in the Shmona Prakim, the Rambam seems to group humility together with other traits. As if to say, if it is always correct that a person should not go to either extreme, the same is true even for humility. And from a certain point of view, this would seem to constitute a contradiction of sorts within the words of the Rambam. In the one place, he advocates extreme humility. In the other place, balanced humility, shall we say. And there's many answers that have been suggested to resolve and harmonize these two comments of Rambam. The Maharal, in the Gur Aryeh, explains that from a certain point of view, the Rambam's words here reflect what is always true when it comes to a person correcting their middos. Rambam says, and many people make a mistake with regards to this, if a person wishes to correct a certain trait, he has a negative trait, and wishes to turn it into a positive trait, you don't always rectify it by going straight for the middle path. Because if a person has been erring on the extreme wrong side, and then he goes towards the middle, he'll tend to keep veering towards the wrong side. You can't advocate the mean if he's coming from one of the extremes. Rather, says Rambam, there is an initial period whereby a person actually needs to go to the other extreme. If a person is very stingy, and then he starts to be somewhat generous, he'll go back to stinginess. He needs to go through a certain period, however it's quantified, of extreme generosity. And when he's redressed that balance, almost as the pendulum goes to the other side, then he'll be able to find his way meaningfully towards the middle. There is a mashal, I don't know if it's the Rambam's mashal, but it's a very helpful mashal. a piece of paper that's been folded in one way doesn't get unfolded by just trying to straighten it out. The correct way to straighten is to fold it the other way, and then after a while you can get a straight entity. And the same is true with regards to humility, for sure. What's interesting, says Maharal, is that the hyssop and the worm, we don't perhaps notice much of a difference between them, but there is a difference between them. Even in humility, the worm is extreme humility. Even the shrub is somewhat raised above the ground. The worm is absolutely lowered to the ground. It's on the ground and it's nothing, practically. And it's interesting to note the order in which these two items come. The first is shnitolas, is the scarlet thread, and then the azo, says Maharal. This is the full program. If he began haughty like a cedar, he's got a first stage one, is to lower himself like a worm, and then he's able to come back to almost total humility. He can't stay a worm indefinitely. The good news is he can become a shrub. He can graduate at a certain point when he can handle that responsibly. So these are the approaches of Maskil HaDavid and Maharal. For Maskil HaDavid, it's Ma'od Ma'od HaVishval Ruach, and for Maharal, it's the two-stage process of rectification. So these are some opening comments with regards to the meaning, shall we say, behind these entities that the Torah prescribes for the purification of the Mitzorah. And we do know that the negative trait that's been implicated above others in this respect is that of Gasus HaRuach. We've mentioned in the past, and worthwhile, any meaningful discussion of the trait of humility, which I'm not sure is discussed really that frequently or at length, is that there is a certain misconception that takes place with regards to the trait of humility. People tend to think that if a person is proud or is haughty, if he has gaiva, so he may publicize his positive qualities, and maybe that's not correct to do so. It's not morally correct, but it is actually more honest because he really is that way. One could almost say that gaiva, that haughtiness, is immoral truth, because it's wrong to say the truth. One shouldn't really say it, but it is true. Humility, on the other hand, is moral falsehood, in the sense that a person makes himself much lower than he is, which is not correct, but it's more moral. But that is the opposite, really, of the definitions, both of gaiva and of anava. The truth of the matter is that it's endemic within a person who is haughty to bloat and inflate their positive qualities way in excess of anything that is remotely true. That's false. It's for this reason the Yetzer Hara is referred to, interesting, coming just off of Pesach, the Yetzer Hara is referred to as yeast. Se'or Shebe'isa, yeast in the dough. What an unusual way to refer to the Yetzer Hara. I'm sure he's been called many things, and none of them are flattering. But to be called yeast seems to be rather arbitrary. Except the point is that the Yetzer Hara does to the person what yeast does to dough. I mean, it makes it out to be much more than its natural ingredients, based on nothing but air. Hot air, typically. And that's gaiva. So gaiva really is false. What then is humility? Humility is true. A person should not be false to what they're capable of, and false to their talents, and false to their kohos. But rather, they need to be true as to where they came from and what they should be used for. And therefore, ultimately, humility is on the side of truth. If a person only has a truthful perspective as to what they should be doing with their lives, so then there's no room for the self-promotion that's within gaiva. One could summarize by saying that a humble person lives for the cause. An arrogant person is the cause. That's not acceptable. As long as a person's ideals are higher than themselves, that's a humble person, and they should be aware of all of their positive qualities. There is a fascinating comment in the Gemara, in the end of Maseches Sota. The Mishnah there, the final Mishnah of Sota, talks about certain eras that came to an end, and certain qualities that vanished when certain people passed from the world. And the Gemara there states that that when Rebbe Yehuda HaNasi passed away, it was the end of humility. No one was really truly humble after Rebbe Yehuda HaNasi, which itself is quite a striking statement, because Rebbe Yehuda HaNasi was anything but shy and retiring. He's the Nasi. He wrote the Mishnayos. He did all those things. And still he was humble, because his entire life was dedicated to Hashem's cause. That's a humble person. And with the passing of Rebbe Yehuda HaNasi, says the Mishnah, that's it. Butla anova. There's no more humility. And one of the most unusual passages of the Gemara takes place just towards the end there, where Rabbi Yosef has a kasha on the Mishnah. Rabbi Yosef of the Gemara. What's his kasha? Says Rabbi Yosef, how can the Mishnah say that there's no more humble people? What about me? That's what he felt, that there was a mistake in the Mishnah. There must be a printer's error or a something. Lotisne anova. Don't put anova there. Toikana. I'm still here. What a thing to say. It almost sounds that he has disqualified himself by opening his mouth. Because if you're so humble, how can you say a thing like that? But the truth of the matter is, true humility, a humble person should even be able to recognize that they're a humble person. Because that's another positive quality. The question is, what is it for? So these are important discussions, because humility should never be an excuse for inactivity. But rather a person enlisting everything they have, but for all the right reasons. Well, one of the well-discussed aspects of the parshas of Tazria and Metzora is the sequence in which the different types of tzaras are presented. If we follow the parsha, we will see that the first type of tzaras in Tazria, Perek Yud Gimel, is tzaras on the body. And there are three types: body, clothing, and house. The first type that is presented by the Torah is tzaras of the body. The second type, tzaras of clothing. And then the third type, which is in Parshas Tazria, is tzaras of a house. Now, what's interesting about that is that in actuality, should it ever happen, the sequence is actually the other way around. It is reversed. As Rambam states, sourced in Chazal, that if a person is behaving not as they should be and they need a bit of a reminder, so the first thing that gets affected is the house. That's message number one. And if they heed the message, well and good. And if not, it gets closer. And then it afflicts their clothing. And if they ignore that message, that's when they get tzaras, the person himself. And that being the case, many Mefarshim, from Rishonim to Achronim, ponder the simple question. Why is the sequence in which the Torah presents the different types of tzaras backwards from the chronological sequence, that if they would happen, they actually would happen? And there are many answers to this question, but I came across a very profound, I believe, approach to this matter in the drushes of the Aruch Laner. In the Aruch Laner of Yaakov Ettlinger, with the Rav of Altona in Germany in the early 1800s, he was one of the Rebbes of Reb Shimshon Erfeld Hirsch. And in this, his drushes are called Minchas Oni. And in our parsha, he quotes his father, who says the following: "We find it is often true," says Rav Ettlinger Sr., "that the Torah will discuss first what happens last." And in fact, an example of that brings us back to Pesach. The final Makkah, as we know, drop of wine number 10, is Makkas Bechoros. Makkas Bechoros was the last Makkah to happen, but it was the first Makkah to be predicted. The very first thing that Moshe says to Paro, right, their first encounter, is "Bini b'chari Yisrael." Yisrael is my firstborn, and if you don't set them free, I'm going to smite your firstborn. "Hine anuchi hareges bincha b'charecha." It's the first thing Paro was told. But it's the last thing that happened. And so what's behind this? What determines whether it's first or last? It can't be both. But the point is, says Rav Ettlinger, very often the true intent of a punishment, which is never purely vindictive, but is always a response to wrongdoing, the ideal is the wrongdoing should never occur. That's the ideal. And what role does the punishment have in ensuring that it never occurs? As a deterrent. Expressing a punishment exists in two capacities. Number one, to know what to do in the event that it's needed. But number two, the warning should be heeded so that it is never necessary as a deterrent. That's the ideal. The ideal of the punishments, the terrorist presentation of their punishments, is that they should never occur, because people should get the message and avoid misbehaving. And therefore, the lechatchila usage of the warning of a punishment is that it shouldn't happen. But if it's as a deterrent, says Rav Ettlinger, so what will serve as the maximum deterrent? A prediction about the worst type of punishment. We assume that the way the punishment happens, it gets increasingly worse. Which means if you wish for the prediction of a punishment to deter people from wrongdoing, so which should you choose? The worst, because that will be the strongest deterrent. And thus you find that Makas Bechoros, it was the last Makkah to happen because it was the worst Makkah for the Mitzrayim. And that's why it was the first thing, because ideally they should have heard that and let the Bnei Yisrael go at the time. As it happened, when Paro refused to listen, then the Makkahs began mercifully by the most mild, everything is relative, but the most mild, and then got increasingly and progressively more difficult. There is an irony here. And the irony is that Paro did not see things that way. Paro drew the complete opposite conclusion. As far as Paro is concerned, if indeed Moshe and the God that he was representing was threatening to kill Paro's firstborn, which is the worst thing, Paro could not fathom why it is that that didn't happen first. For a simple reason. Paro would do it first. In other words, if he's capable of inflicting the worst possible damage, he would do it. Paro himself doesn't recognize the notion of a deterrent, of giving people a chance, of being patient with them, of giving them quarter. There's no such concept. So the irony is that for Paro, patience is misconstrued as weakness. He is not the last person to make that mistake in this region and beyond. And therefore, this in a sense is part of what's behind the phenomenon known as the hardening of Paro's heart. We've discussed in the past that it is not necessarily a purely supernatural phenomenon whereby his decision-making capacities were switched off. But rather, it was a manipulation of the way Paro interprets events. Because for Paro, he has this ongoing, lingering thought whereby it says, you know, he threatened to kill my firstborn, but he hasn't done that yet. It must be he's not as capable as he makes himself out to be. I just need to hold out until I wear him down. So it's a fascinating situation, because what was given to Paro as an act of kindness actually triggered his stubbornness, because he couldn't for the life of them think why else God wouldn't have killed his firstborn if he really could. Coming back to Parshas Tazria, says Rav Ettlinger, we have a similar situation. What is the ideal fulfillment of Parshas Tazria and Metzora? The answer is non-fulfillment. As if to say, the ideal situation with vis-a-vis everything mentioned in this parasha is that it should never happen, because the Jewish people should get the message and not speak Lashon Hara, and not be haughty, and not bring upon themselves any aspect of themselves. And therefore, in keeping with the pattern that we saw with Makas Bechoros as a deterrent, if you always choose the worst for the deterrent to mention first, that is why Tzaras of the body is mentioned first. In actuality, if it ever happens, it happens last, because it's the worst. But for that very reason, as a deterrent, it's mentioned first. And that's why you have this reverse sequential flow of the order in which the types of Tzaras happen, the way the Torah presents it, as opposed to the way it would, if necessary, happen in actuality. It's very interesting to ponder another aspect of moving on or in to the parsha, and that is those who are charged with dealing with the Metzora, and they are none other than the Kohanim. As Perek Yud Gimel begins, Perek Yud Gimel Pasuk Beis, Adam kiyeva or besaros se'esav sapachas u'baheres. If a person has any of these white or off-white or variations of white discolorations, hayaba or besaros le'negat saras, and it is the symptoms of a nega, v'huva el Aaron ha'kohen. He should be brought to Aaron, o el achad mibonav ha'kohenim, or to one of his sons, the kohenim. And thus we find that the condition called saras is directed towards the kohanim, as if to say, and not towards the doctor. And the question is, how is it that the kohanim come to be the ones who relate to this person who has this disease called saras? And Meshech Chochma discusses this question and provides two answers. Firstly, as we know, saras, it is a condition, and it is a physiological condition, but it also is accompanied by a state of tumah, of ritual contamination. And indeed, as the Mitzurah leaves town, he needs to proclaim that he's tomei. People need to kind of stay away from him. Tomei, tomei yikra. And in fact, the tumah of the Mitzurah is very severe. Not only can he be metame things by touching them or by carrying them, even being in the same house as a Mitzurah can also convey tumah, which is only true for one other type of tumah, and that's tumah for a deceased, which says a lot about the way the Torah looks at a Mitzurah. So there is this aspect of tumah. And in fact, this expresses itself in another sense as well. There's a very interesting ruling of the Rambam in Mishneh Torah, in Hilchos Bias Mikdash. As we know, the Mitzurah is sent out of town. Which town? Any town. Or more correctly, any town that has a wall around it, which is many of the cities, however many there were, a few dozen in Eretz Yisrael, he'd be sent out from any of those cities. They answer to that criteria, he's got to be sent out. And he's not allowed back in. And if he comes back in, does he incur any punishment? Says Rambam, it depends. With most cities, no. I mean, if he comes back in, send him out again. But if he comes back into Yerushalayim, he gets malchus. He incurs the punishment of lashes. And this is a very interesting ruling of Rambam, because as far as we're concerned, Yerushalayim is of course a very special place, but how is it different in terms of Hilchos Tzaras to any other city? The Torah doesn't differentiate. The Torah says he's got to be sent out of all cities. So how come if he comes into any of the other cities, we just send him out again, but if he comes into Yerushalayim, he gets punished with malchus? How, in what way is Yerushalayim different? Says Meshech Chochma, because there are two reasons why the Meshech Chochma, why the Mitzurah, pardon me, would be sent out of town. Two very different reasons. One of them is because he needs to be in isolation. That's part of the process of having a bit of a reckoning, a bit of alone time. He's quarantined. That's an ethical reason. There's another reason. He's Tomei. And if a person is Tomei, there's certain places he can't go. And as we said, the tumah of a Mitzurah is very severe. Well, how does this express itself? Says Meshech Chochma, a Mitzurah is not allowed to be in a place which is called Machane Yisrael. Machane Yisrael, as far as the land of Israel is concerned, is Yerushalayim. Those three machanos, it's quite fascinating how this was transposed from the Midbar into Eretz Yisrael, but as surely as in the Midbar you had the Mishkan, which is Machane Shechina, and then around that you had the Leviim, Machane Leviah, and around that you had Machane Yisrael, those three concentric camps. That translates in Eretz Yisrael in the following way. The Beis HaMikdash itself is, and its courtyard is, Machane Shechina, the camp of the Divine Presence. Harabayis around that is Machane Leviah. And Yerushalayim around that is Machane Yisrael. That's where you'll find your three machanos. And the Pasuk states with regards to anyone who is where they're not allowed to be for in terms of these machane reasons, a negative prohibition. Velo yitam'u es machanehem. They shall not contaminate their machane. Each one in terms of what's appropriate. But that losa, say, that negative prohibition applies only to Machane Yisrael. Only Yerushalayim is the only city that has the kedusha of Machane Yisrael. What about other cities? They're Eretz Yisrael, but they don't have the Kedusha of Machane Yisrael. Does he need to be sent out from them? Of course, because he needs to be by himself. He needs to be isolated. But they are all covered by the positive mitzvah of Michutz l'machaneh moshavo, let him be outside the city. You don't get Malkus for violating a positive command, only a negative prohibition. And you see therefore how it comes out, the difference, that whereby, with regards to cities generally, of the two reasons that the Metzora would be sent out, only one of them applies. There is no issue of him contaminating those cities. They're not susceptible to that tumor. They're not affected by it. He needs to be sent out purely for quarantine reasons, for isolation reasons, as a Metzora. That's a positive commandment, the infraction of which there's no Malkus. But when it comes to Yerushalayim, there are now two reasons. Number one, quarantine, like all other cities, but there's a second reason as well, tuma. For lo yitam'u es machanehem. For that, he would get Malkus. And that's why the Rambam says there's only Malkus for Eli Metzora who comes back to Yerushalayim. So it's a classic, if one could borrow a brisker terminology, it's tzvei dinim. It's two ideas, two dynamics that are present in the sending out of the Metzora. As such, says Meshe Chochma, we understand why the Metzora is sent to the Kohanim, because it is within the domain of the Kohanim to deal with matters of Tumah and Tahara, purity and impurity. If there was only the issue of the disease itself, perhaps anyone could treat him, anyone who's qualified. But as soon as you have this accompanying and dominant element of Tumah, it goes straight to the Kohanim. That's why they are the ones chosen to deal with him. The second approach of Meshe Chochma is quite different. And Meshe Chochma, and I'm not sure if everyone agrees with Meshe Chochma about this, although his proofs are quite compelling, that Saras is there's an ongoing question as to whether the Saras that the Torah is speaking about is exactly what we call leprosy or whatever it might be. But however, says Meshe Chochma, the Saras that the Torah is speaking about is nonetheless a contagious disease. It is catchy. Not all concur with that, as far as I know. There are some who say that if it is divinely given to the person as a punishment for his sins, so then you can't catch it from him, because unless you partook of those sins. You're not going to catch tsaras from a person unless you catch lashon hara from them first. But Meshe Chochma is of the understanding that regardless of how it came to the person, once it's there, you've got to keep your distance. And that's why he sent out of town, or of the reasons. And he actually quotes a fascinating medrash by Yikra Rabbah. There's an interesting machlokas. One would never imagine there would be machlokas about this. How far away do you need to stay from a metzora? This is hilchus keeping away from a metzora. One opinion, I believe it's a machlokas, Rabbi Yochanan Reish Lakish. One opinion says 4 amos. You don't want to be within the 4 amos of a metzora. Another opinion says even 100 amos. 100 cubits, keep your distance. Interestingly, says the Gemara, it's not really a machlokas. They're talking about different situations. You know what it depends on, says the Medrash? Whether the wind is blowing. Because if the wind is still, so then you don't want to go within 4 amos. But outside of 4 amos, you're okay. But if the wind is blowing and you're downwind, you don't want to go anywhere near them. Even 100 amos you want to keep away. It's a fascinating comment. I'm not sure exactly when it was commonly understood that a disease could be communicated by air in that way. But that's mefurish in the Medrash. People would ascribe it to all sorts of other things. But it's clear, if the air is carried, so then you need to keep further distance. But what we do see that, from that Medrash is that it's something that can be caught. That being the case, as Meshe Chochma, you have to choose very carefully as to who's going to treat them, because whoever treats them could catch saras. And this is actually a very interesting ongoing question. I mean, in terms of the obligations of a person to heal, sometimes the healer runs a risk of catching whatever it is on the person that they're healing. In this instance, as Meshe Chochma, when choosing the group that will be involved in them, you need to choose a group that is, to the degree that you can ascertain, vouchsafed of divine protection from catching something that they shouldn't be catching. And that group are the Kohanim. As if to say, by virtue of the focus and devotion and dedication and separation of the Kohanim and their as the pasuk says about Aaron, by avdei Hashem, by lakdisho kodesh kadoshim, because they're elevated in that way as a group. That's why they're the ones entrusted, because they're taking a risk, and therefore you want to give it to the group that we understand would be most protected from contracting the tzaras from those that they are treating. So that's the second approach of Meshech Chochmah, quite different than the first, but it all comes back to the Kohanim. I'd like to move from here actually to the Haftorah of Parshas Metzora, which is the famous Arba Metzoraim, those four Metzoraim who are at the gates of the city of Shomron. And as we will see, their experiences are actually of halachic import. And let us see why. There is an important question that is discussed by Poskim, and it relates to a certain situation medically, whereby a person sometimes, unfortunately, can be given only a very short time to live, known as chaye sha'a, very short term. But sometimes there are treatment options that are available, be it surgery or such like, or other. And there's a risk. And the two outcomes are, either if it is successful, it could prolong his life a great deal, what we call chaye olam, or it could end his life there and then. So essentially what he's risking is, to the extent that any of these things are definite, he's risking the definitely of, shall we say, a few days or a few weeks, possibly to gain a few years and possibly to lose everything. And the Gemara discusses this question. Firstly, we should emphasize, as we know in any case, the Torah ascribes absolute value to any duration of life. Even if it's a matter of hours, that's all that can be expected. We see that, number one, from the halakhos of pikuach nefesh. You'd override the rules of Shabbos, even if it's only expected, and by doing so, the person's life will be prolonged for another few hours. It doesn't matter. Similarly, a person in such a situation, that where it's understood that they only have a few hours, if someone were to kill that person, he would be tried as a murderer. There is no notion of, it's just a question of a few hours. Which means that as far as relating to this person as being alive in every sense of the word, that is absolutely understood. However, one can't compare a few hours to perhaps a few years. And this question is discussed by many of the poskim, amongst them Rav Waldenberg in the Shelas HaTshuvos Tzitz Eliezer in Chelek Dalet. And he suggests what one may consider to be a proof in this regard, but then he puts it to the side. What is the proof? There is a well-known statement in the Gemara, it's in two places, in Brachos Samach Beis and Bava Kama Daf Pei Hei, commenting on the words of the Torah about healing, Verapo Yurape, the double expression, Verapo Yurape. And the Gemara says the meaning of this double expression, Verapo Yurape, is, in the well-known words of Gemara, Mikan shenitna rishus larofe larapos. From here we see that permission has been granted by the healer to heal. Verapo Yurape, the Torah says, go ahead, proceed. Nitna rishus larofe larapos. The question is, why should he need permission? I mean, he's only doing a service. I mean, one should perform all manners of kindness. If he knows how to heal, so then he should be able to proceed without the Torah permitting him to do so. Why does he need permission? Rashi famously says, because he may think, listen, if God has given him this illness, who am I to take it away? Maybe he's interfering with the divine affairs. To that end, the Torah says, God has his business, you have your business, and proceed. That's how Rashi explains the requirement for Rishus. But the Ramban, in his Sefer Toras Adam, explains the Gemara quite differently. Ramban says the reason why you need Rishus is because sometimes a person who engages to save someone's life could potentially end their life. If he makes a mistake, if he mistreats them in some way, it's possible. It's always true. to the extent that a person may think it's not worth the risk. I mean, who am I to undertake the risk? It could be that I'll help them, but there's always a possibility that I won't. And so maybe I should not get involved, not one way nor the other. To that end, the Torah says, get involved. If you know how to heal them, there could be a mistake. Proceed. But for that, you need rishus. And that's why the Torah gives rishus. That's the explanation of Ramban. Quite different than Rashi in that respect. Now, says Rav Waldenberg, seemingly the Gemara is discussing our very question. Because you have a person who is, let's say, seriously ill. If no one treats them, it could be a matter of hours or days. If you treat them, you could help them. But you could also end things there and then. And the Torah says, proceed. Is that not an indication that in situations such as this, the directive is to engage, the risk notwithstanding? However, says Rav Waldenberg, there is no conclusive proof from that statement. And the reason is because it could be that when the Torah gives you rishus, it's because if you know what you're doing and you're diligent and careful, everything will be okay. If you're not careful, then there could be a problem. Then things could go terribly wrong. Therefore, when the Torah gives you rishus to engage, it says engage and be careful. You don't need to worry that you won't be careful. Be worried and be careful. But when there's a risk which is out of your hands, even if you do your best, you know from the outset it might things may end on the table. So there we don't know. Maybe the question is still open as to whether it's correct to risk what's called chaye sha'a, short term, for the benefit potentially of long term, but with the counter possibility of being immediate a demise. But a much more direct answer to this question is found in the Gemara in Maseches Avodah Zarah and Daf Taf Zayin, and is based on the Haftarah of our Parsha. The Gemara has a couple of guidelines with regards to going to doctors, specifically Gentile doctors, or actually more specifically Babylonian doctors. It's important to mention that it shouldn't be in any way taken as a slight or anyway a denigration. But it was known that the Babylonian doctors, they did not hold much care for Jewish life. Which means actually, when a person would go to a doctor such as that, they were taking a risk. If life was dangerous before they went to the doctor, it could be even worse, actually going to the doctor. There were no repercussions, there was no... And therefore, the Gemara says as follows. Suffolk mace, if a person is not definitely facing death, better not to go to a Babylonian doctor. That's what the Gemara says. But if he's definitely facing a near an imminent demise, so then it's worth taking a chance because the alternative is definite. So the only circumstances that a person is encouraged or maybe even allowed to visit this Babylonian doctor is if otherwise he will definitely die. But then the Gemara says, well, even if he'll definitely die, but that will take a while. This Babylonian doctor could kill him on the spot. So how is it still correct? But the Gemara says, yes, but it's worth it. In other words, even if it's 50-50, it's worth it. Because it's worth risking what's called chaye sha'a, these hours or days, for the possibility that he may receive months and years. And how do we know this? It's such a weighty question. And it's ma'aseh b'chol yom. It's a very prevalent situation. How do we know this? Says the Gemara, because look at the Haftarah for Parshas Metzora. You have these Arba Metzoraim, background. Where are they and why are they there? They're outside the city of the Shomron because they're Metzoraim, they were sent out. And who's inside Shomron? All the Jews. Who's outside Shomron? The city, the army of Aram. Aram had laid siege to the city of Shomron. And now you have these four Mitzrayim, and they're just in the worst place one could envisage. All of their options do not look good. They just seem worse than the other. But there's no food. They have no food. And there's no food in the city. The whole city of of Shomron is starving. They've been sieged to starvation by the surrounding Aramean army. And basically, these four Mitzrayim said, we've got to do something. Because if we don't, then we're just going to die of starvation. It's a matter of another day or two. So you've got to take a chance. And these are their words. If we try and get back into the city, even if they let them back, maybe Tsaras wasn't considered a high-level priority by that stage because everyone was starving. Even if they let us in, what is there? Nothing. Famine. V'harav ba'ir. B'mas nusham. There's famine there. So if we get into the city, we're going to die in the city. What other alternative is there? Stay here and do nothing. V'imir shavnu po, b'mas nu. If we stay here, we're going to die. V'ato. There's only one thing to do. We've got to take a chance. We've got to go and present ourselves to the camp of Aram. We have no idea what they're going to do. Maybe they'll take us in. Maybe they'll kill us on the spot. If they keep us alive, then we'll live. And if they kill us, we'll die. But and it could happen straight away. And that's really the point of the Gemara, as if to say we're back to the situation. Here they are, it's a terrible situation, but they're starving, they have another few hours or a few days or whatever it is. If they go to Aram, they may bring them back to life, but they could kill them on the spot. So they're taking a risk. And they did it. And the Gemara says, based on that analysis and based on that initiative, you see that in a situation such like this, it is acceptable and correct for a person to take a risk, even with regards to potential chayei shoah, in order to allow themselves longevity for chayei olam. It is a chiddush, actually, that the Gemara adduces halachas from these four mitzrayim, as if to say, we're not aware that they're, let's say, halachic experts. In fact, there's only one thing we know for sure that they've done, and they did it wrong, otherwise they wouldn't be Mitzrayim. And one of them is Gehazi, by the way, according to Masorah Gehazi, and Gehazi is not looked upon so favorably. And yet, I just mention it as a point to note, that we may have been inclined to say, we may have said, they can do what they want. I'm not going to pass on halachas based on them, but the Gemara does. The Gemara concurs with their analysis. In the end, just as we know from the Haftarah, all of the Aramean army had fled, which means when they came there, the place was full of food, and they then had the pleasant task of telling the city of Shomron that the siege was off and food was available. But this is the halacha which is derived from the Haftarah, and what's fascinating is there is a wonderful sefer on Nevi'im called Nachalas Shimon. The author is American, and he discusses this whole matter, and he says if you look carefully at the words of the pasuk, you'll see the nuance bears out what the Gemara is saying. Because once again, there, when they say we should, let's go and throw ourselves at the mercy of Machane Aram, lechu v'nipla al Machane Aram, im yechayunu nichye, if they keep us alive, we'll live. V'im yemisunu, and if they'll kill us, famasnu. The two sides. What's so interesting here? What's interesting is there seems to be an asymmetry with regards to the phraseology. Because when it comes to being alive, it says, im yichayunu, if they will keep us alive, v'nichye, then we will live. The counter should have been, v'im yimisunu, v'namus. And if they kill us, then we'll die. But it doesn't say, v'im yimisunu, v'namus. It says, v'im yimisunu, v'amosnu, then we died. But not yet. How come it's not phrased in the future? It says in Nachlas Shimon, you see from these words what the Gemara is saying. The point is that they are justifying this course of action because it could have a positive outcome. Yichayunu, v'nichye, and then that will happen. If it has a negative outcome, that's something that would have happened anyway. That's the point. Imimisunu, if they'll kill us, yes, but we're already dead because it's just a few hours or days that would have happened anyway, and therefore you see from the shift it's such a subtle turn here, but the moving from the future to the past is further crystallizing how it is that this is the correct course of action. So that's a very interesting discussion. You know, the Haftarah is fascinating as it is, but just to see how halacha lemaisa, the poskim are basing themselves on the Gemara, which itself is based on this. Let's conclude by referring back again to the purification of the Metzorah, which is where we started. You've got the hyssop, and it's dipped in blood, and then sprinkled on the Metzorah. And the Ibn Ezra has a fascinating comment with regards to this part of the procedure. And that is, says Ibn Ezra, there is one other time when a hyssop is dipped in blood and then sprinkled, and that is Korban Pesach. We're back again to Pesach. In Yetzias Mitzrayim, they were told to take an Agudas Ezo, dip it in blood, and put it on the lintel, on the post of the door. And Ibn Ezra says, because this is like that, the purification of the Metzorah, it's like Yetzias Mitzrayim, and that's why it has this in common. Now that, of course, is quite a statement. It's rather enigmatic. In what way is the Metzorah, the purification of the Metzorah, like Yetzias Mitzrayim? I mean, he seems to have enough troubles. He doesn't need to be in Mitzrayim. How do the two correspond? But the truth is that connections between the condition of the Metzorah and the concept of Golus go further. There is a Medrash we've discussed at length on another occasion, but just to reference the Medrash. According to the Medrash Vayikra Rabbah, all four exiles of the Jewish people are alluded to in the opening pasuk of Tzaraas, where it says, Adam ki yeba or b'sarah, if a person has in the skin of his flesh, se'es o sapachas o baheres, and it shall be l'nega Tzaraas, and the Vayikra Rabbah connects these four types of Tzaraas to the four Golios. How? That, as we said, is a broader discussion. But we do see that compacted within the concept of Tzaraas is indeed that of Golus. Moreover, even the Golus of Mitzrayim is also connected to Tzaraas. How so? The very first mention of Tzaraas in the Torah is Moshe's hand. When he put it into his tunic and then he came out, it was Mitzaraas Kashelek. Why? Aside from what Moshe said about Bnei Yisrael, the Yalkut says that these two signs, the snake, right, the staff became a snake, and the hand became leprous, correspond to the Egyptians and explain why they're deserving of punishment. Because they damaged the Jewish people physically, like a snake can kill, and they contaminated them spiritually, like Mitzrayim. The very first reference of Tzaraas comes within the context of our first Golus as a nation. It is true as well, as we referred to before, and it's part of the understanding, the Mitzrayim himself undergoes a personal Golus. In the sense that he's quarantined. He's isolated. But Dad Yeshev, Michutz L'machaneh Moshavah. He's got to be by himself. He's got to be outside the camp. He's sent out. He's sent into exile. And the halachas are very strict about his quarantine. It's not just for health reasons. It's not just that people shouldn't catch his tzaraas. The halacha states that not only is he not allowed to be in town, he can't even keep the company of other mitzrayim. They've all got to be by themselves. I mean, that's a real shlamazel of a person. He not only is he a Mitzorah, and healthy people can't be with him, even other Mitzorayim can't be with him. An absolute isolation. Why? So, Mefarshim explain that all the symptoms, or more correctly, all the causes that lead to Tzaraas are really causes whereby a person is isolated from people. Even when he circulates with them, even when he mixes with them. That means that a person who's overly arrogant, or a person who's over-consumed by jealousy, or all of those things, they don't really relate to the world in any meaningful or realistic way. They have their own goals, their own map of everything, and their own definitions of success and how people are meaningful or useful to them. And that world is inhabited by them alone. It's a very important concept, very thought-provoking. Because ultimately, when a person has the symptoms that could lead to tzaras, if a person has the negative traits to a chronic degree that could lead to tzaras, they are already in isolation, even as they move among people. And that is a concept which is summed up by the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, which states, well, in Mishnah, Hakina, Tava v'Kavod, jealousy and lust and honor, Motzien es Adam min ha'olam, they take a person out of the world. And Mefarshim are quite keen to find out, well, where do they put him? Because he seems to be still here. So by what measure has he been taken out of the world? And the answer is by any meaningful measure. He is very, really not in the world. Because he's in his own world. And no one else lives there. From a certain point of view, the quarantine and the isolation of the Metzora is merely to give him a chance for his aloneness to catch up with him. In other words, for his condition physically to finally reflect his condition experientially. And to realize and perhaps appreciate people in a way that he did not before, for themselves, not just for how they can be useful to him, or which is a warped vision of his surroundings. So he really is in Golis. And when he comes back, it's his own form of redemption. And that's why the concept of exile and saras are so closely linked. One is for the individual and one is for the nation. But the factors in play are very similar. And that's when he comes back, it's like he's leaving Mitzrayim. He's got his whole hyssop and it's dipped in the blood. It's mamish like he's coming back from Mitzrayim. He's coming back to Geula. And that with that he's redeemed. And the truth is, the same is true as well for the Jewish people. Very often, the concept of exile of the Jewish people is if they themselves are not meaningfully present in Eretz Yisrael. In the same way that a person who may move among people but he's not related to them properly, he may as well not be there. The land of Israel exists for the Jewish people for a reason, as the Torah says repeatedly, and as the Nevi'im and the Ksuvim say, "Ba'avu yishmeru chukav." And it's not anybody else's land, it's the Jewish people's land, but it's the Jewish people's land for a reason. And sometimes Golus begins when the Jewish people wish to be in their land for reasons no more elevated than other people wish to be in their land. And from a certain point of view, they're not connecting meaningfully with the land. Golus begins in Eretz Yisrael, as with the Metzora itself. And if the Jewish people should ever be exiled, that's also their state catching up with themselves. And Baruch Hashem, the Jewish people have been coming back, Kibbutz Golios, but that should certainly be taken only as further encouragement to be sure that when the Jewish people are back, they should be back in Eretz Yisrael in all senses of the word. Back in Eretz Yisrael for the reason the Jewish people should be in Eretz Yisrael. Because if we're fully there, that vouchsafes for us the need or the requirement ever for us to be elsewhere. Perhaps one may say that we're most entitled to look forwards to the future when we ourselves are present in Eretz Yisrael. So these are certainly sentiments worthy of our attention and contemplation during these special times. Mitzvah Hashem, the process that has begun should come to its culmination. B'mehirah b'yameinu, amen.